We'd like to ask that you stick around to the end of this episode to hear a promo for our friend Cassandra's podcast, Of Myth and Mercy. The cases presented by Of Myth and Mercy are generally obscure and incredibly interesting. I often find myself either never having heard the subject they're covering or never having known the details therein. We highly recommend it. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several varying donation levels to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels and Patreon-exclusive episodes available at most levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. You can interact with Gone Cold Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching Gone Cold Podcast. Now onto the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
El Paso, short for El Paso del Norte, which is Spanish for the Pass of the North, rests in the far western corner of Texas. The dusty city sits on the Rio Grande River, just across the border from Juarez, Mexico. Rich in history, the Mexican and Texan governments grappled for its control until Texas irrevocably took control in 1846. The early 1880s brought the railroads into the desert town, and it was recorded a mere 736 residents lived in the county seat at that time. Industry and mining began transforming the city as El Paso made its turn out of the 19th century into the 20th, and the start of an economic boom took place shortly thereafter in the 1920s, due in part to major business developments. The Great Depression hit the city hard, though, and its population dwindled as families moved to larger cities looking for work. United States Army Post Fort Bliss was founded in El Paso in 1854, and by 1941, the installation was the largest cavalry post in the nation, and it is now the second largest military installation in the United States. Crossing the border into Juarez was a common occurrence for military personnel and civilians alike at this point, and though El Paso certainly wasn't a pinnacle of innocence, the Mexican city of Juarez was chock full of pleasures and debaucheries, lacking in its American sister city. Military expansion, oil discoveries, and copper smelting created a rapid economic expansion on the cusp of the mid-19th century. With this boom came the proliferation of low-wage industries, which once again drove families to other cities in search for better-paying jobs. Cheap labor was difficult to come by, particularly due to demands for military and war supplies during World War II, and from 1942 to 1956, the U.S. enacted the Bracero program, which brought cheap labor from Mexico to fill these needs, and the border town of El Paso took full advantage. By 1950, the bustling little city, nestled into the base of the Franklin Mountain Range, had reached a population of 130,000. The city is currently home to almost 700,000 residents. As El Paso has continued to grow year by year, so has its folklore, legends, and mysteries. Local legends including La Llorona, the Juan de Oñate hidden treasure, the underground tunnels that honeycomb the town, the witch house on Scenic Drive, and the peculiar disappearances of William and Margaret Patterson have all continued to captivate the residents of El Paso for decades. For the past 60 years, the 1957 vanishing of the Pattersons has sparked speculation ranging from kidnapping to murder, alien abduction to espionage. While much is unknown about what happened to the couple, the mysterious circumstances surrounding the event is still talked about today. The story of Margaret and William Patterson's disappearance is undoubtedly complicated and convoluted, so please bear with us. William Durrell Patterson was born July 23, 1904, in Chicago, Illinois. He was the oldest child and only son of the five children born to Luther Melville Patterson, a traveling salesman from Kansas, and Marguerite Ann France, a housewife and Illinois native. William, who most often went by the nickname Pat, grew up in a two-story home in the small suburb of Maywood, located in the township of Proviso. In this lower-income neighborhood, William learned at an early age to have a fast right hook that packed quite a punch, but he would become an even faster talker since it was, perhaps, in his best interests to manipulate an altercation with words rather than with fists. Coming from a poor neighborhood and from a family who, at times, had trouble providing the necessities, William often daydreamed of riches and luxury. At age 15, William learned that if he was ever going to have the things, the money, that he desired, he needed to work. He began working in a factory making cabinets. However, William was a self-aware young man. He knew better than anyone that he had a gift, one that had been precisely honed and polished on the streets. At age 16, he left home because he'd landed a job as a carny, touring the country and quick-selling the crowds into dropping their nickels on the near-impossible-to-win carnival games. Working as a barker for several different circuses in his adolescence and early adulthood, the silver-tongued and perhaps slightly devilish young man easily convinced country and city folk alike that the exhibits were something they couldn't live without seeing for themselves. William rarely wrote to his family as he wandered the country. On one occasion, while in Georgia, William was picked up on a charge of vagrancy. Using his skills of articulate persuasion, he convinced the judge to set him free. The magistrate was no match for William's tales of struggles, trials, and tribulations. The judge felt so moved, in fact, that he gave William a few bucks before sending the hapless youth on his way. Soon after, however, the judge caught William taking a swim in a pool, relaxed and seemingly without a care in the world. Feeling deceived, the judge sentenced William to 30 days on the Georgia State Chain Gang. William was not an individual who would take for granted an experience that provided such great potential for new knowledge, and would later say that working on the chain gang was the most educationally rewarding experience he'd ever had. He eventually landed work as a traveling product demonstrator for a chemical company, which led the young man to concoct his own spot remover by mixing soap flakes with other chemicals. William successfully peddled his miracle cleaner all over the Midwest. A born salesman and extraordinarily industrious, William was naturally intelligent and well socialized by the streets. He was proud of his ability to take care of himself by hawking gimmicks and novelties on street corners, stores, and carnivals all over the country. William seemed to prefer jobs that were easy to come by and hard to track. In the early 1930s, as fate would have it, William's travels led him to the Hotel Vendome coffee shop in Evansville, Indiana, where a hostess named Margaret greeted him. William was immediately taken aback by the young red-headed woman's beauty, charm, and assertiveness. Margaret Matilda Kiefer was born December 29, 1905, to German-born John Jacob Kiefer and Kentucky native Mary Josephine O'Brien. Margaret, or Tilly, as her family called her, was born and grew up on the O'Brien's farm in Curdsville, Kentucky. She was the fifth Kiefer child to be born on the farm. Margaret's family was large. She had five sisters and three brothers. The O'Brien's farm, which grew corn and raised hogs, had been in her mother's family for several generations. Never satisfied with the country life, Margaret daydreamed about something bigger and better. She left home at an early age, setting out for the city to seek her fortune. A couple that rented to Margaret in Evansville, Indiana, later described her as, quote, a real beauty, who often wore clothes she could not have possibly afforded. William and Margaret's romance blossomed fast, and on June 21, 1933, Margaret Kiefer and William Patterson obtained a marriage license in Franklin County, Ohio. True to form, 27-year-old Margaret falsified the marriage application with a claim that she was only 23. She was, according to friends, constantly concerned with her appearance and seemingly always looking for a way to thwart the aging process. Sometime after marrying William, Margaret cut off all ties with her family. She apparently told friends that she was given an ultimatum by her family to choose them or William, and backfiring, as ultimatums often do, she chose William. Like Margaret, William always dreamed of a bigger and better life. The couple kicked around the country for many years as William taught Margaret the tricks of the trade of being a pitchman, a person that solicited goods with gusto and often promises of life-altering experiences at the hands of the miracle product they peddled. It is said that Margaret turned out to be quite the pitchman herself. Sometime in the 1930s, William began promoting and selling a reflex-type camera, becoming interested in and learning the ins and outs of photography in the process. As with every fresh object and concept that William encountered, he began contemplating how he could turn this camera and photography into something lucrative. His idea took the couple to Dallas, and William tried to make a living as a kidnapper, a term used by pitchmen that meant, to put simply, a sidewalk photographer whose selling tactics teeter the line between ethical and dishonest. He wasn't too successful there, so the Pattersons decided to pack up and move west to El Paso in 1940 to try their luck there. Things didn't improve much for their first 3 years in the West Texas town. By 1942, while World War II raged, the Pattersons were living in a broken-down house trailer with two cats and a dog, their total net worth a mere $35. It was also during this time that William, who often made trips across the border, began getting a taste of the good life he'd so desperately wanted. During the war, all available nylon and silk were being used to make parachutes and tents, and production of the material was reserved solely for the war effort. This made women's nylon stockings a precious commodity, and since women flooded the stores, bought up, and hoarded all available stockings, as quickly as their production had been halted, a shortage and much more than modest inflation in price was created. William's mind, of course, immediately realized a business opportunity, and he began selling nylon stockings on the black market, smuggling them in from Mexico. It is said he made a substantial profit doing so. Around this time, William began hiring employees to kidnap for him, dressing them in all-white uniforms with the word Hollywood embroidered on their caps. He purchased a shiny new Pontiac and was able to rent a cubbyhole-sized office where he sold photo supplies. The Pattersons' luck was beginning to change, as they say, but luck didn't have anything to do with it. William and Margaret's opportunistically industrious thinking and incredible fortitude were the culprits. In 1944, the Pattersons hit pay dirt when William persuaded a lender to put up a small loan without any collateral. He and Margaret opened Patterson Photo Supply, located at 3815 Alameda Avenue in the Caples Building. Still what you'd call a hole in the wall, but forward momentum nonetheless. While William ran the photo supply store, Margaret handled the financial end. Margaret was known to keep a tight grip on the purse strings as their business grew. In 1947, the Pattersons purchased a home at 3000 Piedmont Drive, which nestled into the foothills of the Franklin Mountains. By 1950, business was booming, and the couple moved their store to 113 North Main Street in downtown El Paso, a much larger and nicer space. The Pattersons were doing well, and according to everyone that knew them, living it up. They were flaunting their success with expensive diamond rings and fancy watches, among other things. Though William did not carry a lot of cash on his person, he loved to flash $100 bills whenever, wherever, and to whomever he could. William bought Margaret two expensive mink coats, which were stolen in 1951. One was later recovered in New Mexico, and the other was never found. By the mid-50s, the Pattersons Photo Supply Company was doing over $350,000 in business, which would equate to over an astounding $3.2 million in today's money. This afforded the Pattersons with property in Guaymas, Mexico, a brand new 1956 Cadillac, a new Volkswagen Karmann Ghia, several lots of land around El Paso, a nice house trailer, a boat, interest in a high-end boat company, and expensive fishing tackle. William was said to have been a master fisherman. He often went on fishing trips to Mexico, Florida, and the West Coast. Friends reported that William was a man who wanted only the best in life. He was known for his nice clothes and expensive jewelry, trying to make up for the years growing up when he didn't have anything, his friends always supposed. Though generally a good guy, his friends declared, William was also a braggart. He was flashy and liked to boast about his good fortunes to anyone who would give him the time to do so. But for all their extravagance, Margaret's mink coats and William's $200 suits, they lived a relatively quiet and reserved life. They were well liked by those who knew them and had many friends. Neighbors observed visitors at the Patterson home often. They did not have children and continued to tell friends little about their lives before moving to El Paso. Those closest to the Pattersons, who thought they knew the couple inside and out, realized later that they really didn't know much about them at all. They'd been left in the dark about so many details that friends generally share with one another. Margaret's friends would later state, in fact, that she never told them specifics about her childhood, even where she was from, when her birthday was, or how she and William met. If and when William talked about his boyhood, he indicated that it was full of hard knocks and just left it at that. No matter the state of their personal relationships, the Pattersons were well established into the community and doing well for themselves. They'd made a ton of healthy business relationships and were close enough to most of them to call friends. Perhaps the Pattersons' strongest business tie was Duffy Sasser, as his business, Duffy's Photo Service, and Patterson Photo Supply Company were inextricably connected through their very natures. Duffy Sasser and his associates will become a vital part of at least one of the theories in this case, so a brief synopsis is in order. Duffy's Photo Service was started by Duffy Sasser in Clovis, New Mexico as Fox Photo, but the name obviously was eventually changed. Since photographic materials were rationed or taken during World War II, Duffy and his wife Vivian decided they'd meet the demands for the photography industry and set up a small darkroom in their home. They used surplus and scrap film ends from the nearby airbase, mixed with their own chemicals, and wound hand-cut strips of film onto spools. Duffy and Vivian Sasser developed pictures for the customers of camera shops and drugstores around eastern New Mexico. Even after the war, the business flourished and expanded into multiple photo processing locations, including El Paso, Texas, where they became acquainted with the Pattersons. On Monday, March 4th, 1957, Cecil and Tessie Ward joined the Pattersons at their home for a quiet get-together. Tessie and Cecil Ward, who owned and operated the Ward Motor Clinic in El Paso, which opened in 1946, were among William and Margaret's closest friends. After dining, William and Cecil retreated to the garage to work on the 18-foot boat William had been slowly fixing up for some time. They used Cecil's electric sander to smooth the wood before applying a coat of acrylic paint. Tessie and Margaret sat in the living room chatting. Though Tessie had insisted on helping Margaret clean up the dinner mess, Margaret refused, opting to sit and visit instead. When William and Cecil called it quits for the night, they brought the electric sander into the house for safekeeping. The two made plans to continue fixing up the boat most evenings that week. He talked about what we would do on the boat the other nights during the week, and about plans for fishing and doing a lot of other things in the spring and summer, Cecil later told the El Paso Herald Post. The Wards called it an evening, said their goodbyes, and headed home. According to Cecil, the following day, Tuesday, March 5th, at approximately 2 p.m., William and Margaret stopped by the Ward Motor Clinic in their Cadillac and asked him to check out the air cooler at their residence. Cecil drove to the residence, checked the air cooler, and returned to the garage at about 4:30 p.m. Though they'd planned to meet that evening to work on the boat, Cecil said that he was feeling under the weather and couldn't make it. The following morning, Wednesday, March 6, 1957, at about 7:15 a.m., a mechanic by the name of Nicholas Alvarez unlocked the garage door and opened the Ward Motor Clinic for business. A dark-complexioned man pulled into the driveway in the Patterson's Cadillac. Not recognizing the man, Alvarez cautiously watched the stranger park the car and exit the vehicle. Waiting was another man who'd been trailing the stranger, driving a tan 1953 or 1954 Chevrolet. The Cadillac driver climbed into the Chevrolet's passenger side, and the men drove off without explanation. It is certain that neither of these men were William Patterson. Doyle Kirkland entered the Ward Motor Clinic at 8 a.m. to instruct Cecil Ward to fix a few issues the car was having. Retired United States Air Force Lieutenant Doyle Gray Kirkland, also known as D.G. Kirkland, or Kirk, managed Duffy's photo processing facility in Lubbock, Texas. This location was the company's headquarters. In some capacity, Kirkland oversaw at least the business aspect of Duffy's Photo Service branch in El Paso, having moved to the West Texas city in 1955 when it opened, and was introduced to the Pattersons through Duffy. Cecil asked Doyle Kirkland what he was doing handling the Cadillac, but Kirkland brushed him off, telling him that the Pattersons were going on a little vacation. Kirkland told Cecil that William had called him and said that he left the Cadillac at the motor clinic and wanted it serviced. The horn ring was broken, and he wanted the car cleaned. The car key was in the glove compartment, and Kirkland also said that William requested he retrieve the keys to Patterson's photo supply, which were attached to the vehicle's key, out of the glove compartment as well. Nothing was out of the ordinary the afternoon prior when he'd seen the Pattersons, and Cecil was perplexed at Kirkland's explanation, as he'd been to the Pattersons' home two evenings before having dinner and helping with the boat, and neither of them mentioned going on vacation. In fact, Cecil and William had made plans to work on the boat further several evenings that week. Margaret never mentioned anything at all about plans for a trip, Cecil's wife Tessie Ward told the paper. They drove by the motor clinic and talked to us. They said nothing about plans to go away, she added. It wasn't unusual for William and Margaret to travel or have their employees handle their affairs when they traveled, so the Wards didn't really think too much about it. On Friday, March 8th, Cecil called Patterson Photo Supply and asked an employee to go pick up the electric sander he'd left at the Patterson home and bring it to his shop. Not long after, Kirkland showed up with the sander. The employees at the photo shop were instructed to tell anyone who inquired about the Pattersons' whereabouts or called to speak with them that the couple was on vacation. Again, Margaret and William often vacationed for extended periods without informing anyone of their exact whereabouts or how to reach them, it has been reported. Herbert Roth was an accounts manager, assistant credit manager, and office manager for the auditing firm Buckner & Bimark. He'd been the Pattersons' accountant for 8 years. Both Roth and his wife, Jenny, were originally from New Jersey and had been in El Paso for 24 years by 1957. The Roths were close friends and associates of the Pattersons. On Friday, March 15th, Herbert Roth received a telegram from Dallas, signed only Pat, William's nickname. It read,
"Sorry to have to leave so sudden. Sell house trailer and use money for business. License both cars for business. Tell Art to cancel DC reservation and take care of business like it was his, as part will be someday. Put Kirkland in complete charge at same salary Duffy pays him. Work with both of them. Tell Kirkland to rent house for 9 months at least. Handle all this as quietly as possible. Important. Sure you will understand. Pat."
The Pattersons' absence wasn't necessarily out of the ordinary to those outside of the couple's innermost circle, and even some within. Nothing appeared amiss. That is, until Tommy showed up. Margaret, friends said, loved Tommy more than anything on earth. It was reported that Margaret treated the yellow, bushy-tailed tabby like a mother treats a child. She doted on him, adorning him with the best collars money could buy. And it was even rumored that she fed Tommy caviar instead of kibble. Anyone who knew the Pattersons knew that Tommy lived like a king. Like for themselves, the Pattersons expected nothing less than the best for their cat. Never liking Tommy to be left alone, Margaret often took him with her on her ventures out of the house. Tommy once accompanied Margaret to the photo supply store and went exploring. After he didn't return, the Pattersons quickly placed an ad in the local paper, offering a liberal reward to anyone who could provide information leading to his whereabouts. Margaret had spent over $500, or $4,600 today, on 9-year-old Tommy's medical needs over the course of his life, always making sure Tommy was happy and healthy. When they traveled, Tommy wasn't left alone with a bowl of water and dried kibble, but boarded at the D.L. Katie Animal Hospital, where he was treated like royalty. About a month after the last time the Pattersons were seen, Mrs. Nathan Sherwin, the couple's neighbor, reported that her son walked into the house and exclaimed, "Mother, Tommy is back." Tommy was thin, disheveled, and nervous. He appeared to have been living a rough existence. The feline was making rounds to several homes in the neighborhood looking for food, and once fed, he would return to the Patterson home. Neighbors began wandering and talking, as it was unimaginable that Margaret would, under any circumstance, leave her precious Tommy to fend for himself. Suspicions that the Pattersons hadn't simply gone on vacation began to transpire. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, we'll discuss the bizarre circumstances behind William and Margaret Patterson's disappearance. If you have any information about the disappearances of William and Margaret Patterson, please contact the El Paso County Sheriff's Department at 915-538-2292. We would like to thank Richard O. Jones from the True Crime Historian Podcast for contributing his time and voice to this episode. You can find True Crime Historian wherever you listen to podcasts. We highly recommend it. The El Paso Times and the El Paso Herald Post were used as source material for this episode. Please remember to stay tuned for a promo from the Great of Myth and Mercy podcast. And if you're interested in all things true crime, you should probably check out thetruecrimefiles.com. There you'll find well-presented cases, many unknown or ignored by the media, as well as book reviews, podcast reviews, and guest posts. TheTrueCrimeFiles.com is an amazing resource for learning about cases you might not be aware of otherwise. Check it out. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Obscure cases, lesser-known crimes, horrific incidents hardly if ever covered before. Uncovering and exposing all of these is the modus operandi of what every Of Myth and Mercy podcast episode aims to do. My name is Cassandra, and I invite you to check us out on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms. Check out our website at ofmythandmercy.com. Listen in and remember the question that Charles Bukowski asked. Mercy, I ask? Mercy? What does the human race know about mercy?